Let us look again at the book of Nehemiah. Tonight we're going to chapter 6. Now, if you look at the chapter, draw your attention first of all to one verse. Then as we go down through the chapter, I want you to keep the words of this verse in mind. Verse 15, chapter 6, verse 15. So the wall was finished in the 25th day of the month Elul, in 52 days. So the wall was finished. Keep that in mind now as we go back and look at chapter 6. Keep in mind what we have already studied in past studies. It was the exercise of a man. No doubt that exercise was born of a work of the Holy Spirit. His exercise was for the welfare of the people of God and for the things of God. When he heard of the awful condition of ruin up in Jerusalem, he gave himself to prayer. And he decided that these walls should be built. Almost an impossible task. In fact, we'll say this, it was an impossible task for one man. But it wasn't impossible for him to think of the work being done. So we saw how he prayed about it. The Lord answered his prayer. He was given permission to go. He solicited the help of others. The work began. Then there was the opposition. Opposition from without. Then we saw in chapter 5, difficulties from within. Now if we learn no other lesson from it than this, we should keep in mind that whenever you determine to do a work for God, no matter what it may be a simple work, or it may be a great work, whatever work you decide to do for God, remember, you'll get opposition. The devil won't let you off with it. But you don't give up just because you get opposition. You keep going on. Then there will be difficulties from the inside. These have got to be overcome. And finally, you come to the point where the work is finished. Let us look at the opening verses now of the chapter. See some of the final difficulties that came against him. Now it came to pass when Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem, the Arabian, and the rest of our enemies heard that I had builded the wall and that there was no breach left therein, though at that time I had not set up the doors upon the gates, that Sanballat and Geshem sent unto me, saying, come, let us meet together in some one of the villages in the plain of Ono. But they thought to do me mischief. Now let us stop there for a moment or two. Two things we've got to learn from verse 2. Number one, here was a very subtle proposition. Now, when a proposition comes from your enemies, you can rest assured there's something subtle about it. They come to your door. They come to my door. Good afternoon, sir. And they have a little Bible in their hand. We would like to spend a little time with you sharing a Bible meditation. Do they come to you like that? Subtle. No Bible meditation do they want to share with you. But I have tried them. Whenever I begin to share a Bible meditation with them, they get angry. One said, you'll not listen to me. I said, no, you're right. I wouldn't listen to you. But you don't know a thing you're talking about. You've never studied your Bible. But they want to share a little Bible meditation. And others will come and they'll have the Book of Mormon along with the Bible. It's the Book of Mormon they want to share with you. The enemy knows how to make the approach. But watch how subtle it was here. Come, come, let us meet together in some one of the villages in the plain of Ono. Leave your work there. Leave what you're doing. Come on. Let us consider this thing. Let us get together and have a little conference about it. And then perhaps we'll come to an understanding. How subtle. Anything to get the man to give up the work. But I like the words at the end of verse 2, but they thought to do me mischief. Here was spiritual perception. You see, the man who knew what it meant to be exercised about the things of God, the man in chapter 1 who knew how to get down on his face before the Lord and cry to the Lord for help, the man who knew how to present it to the Lord when he was having difficulties within, he's got the perception to know that there's something subtle about this. He's got spiritual perception. It's a great gift, that. Let me illustrate that to you from an incident in the New Testament. Here the disciples are on the Sea of Galilee. And all of a sudden, they see somebody on the waves. It's a ghost. Look, it's a spirit, it's a ghost, and they're afraid. You would get a bit shaken up too if you thought you saw a ghost, wouldn't you? I'm sure you would. They didn't say there's an angel, but they knew there was something peculiar about it. But you remember what John said. John said, it's the Lord. How did John know? It was the Lord. And you remember, John was the one who was always nearest to the Lord. And the man who was always keeping nearest to the Lord was able to determine that is the Lord. You see, here was a man who had spiritual perception. Back here in the book of Nehemiah. John had spiritual perception. He said, it's the Lord. He was a man who could come to grips with the situation. He says, but they thought to do me mischief. He knew that. And he wasn't going to fall into the trap. And the lesson for you and me is this, neither should we. If with spiritual discernment, we'll not fall into the devil's trap. You know, I set a trap in my garden for squirrels. I've caught a few now, coming up to almost 3 dozen. I take them all over to some of the buddy's territory, let them out. And you know, it's interesting to watch those brutes. And you put a nice bit of bait in for them. You don't just put the trap down and leave it. Put a nice piece of bread in there away at the back of the trap, and you watch them, and they go up the top and they look in. They come to the side and they look in. Then they go hopping round about, and then they look in at the end. They don't hear what I'm saying, but I'm saying, go and get in and get it. See? They don't hear me. Then I watch them, they just take a little hop in, and there they trim it up, and then they make a noise. And they've got, you know, the little birds, they can go in and they can take away that bread, and they're not heavy enough to trip it up. The squirrel does, see? The trap is set. The bait is there. And in they go, caught. And the old devil knows how to set the trap for you and for me. He doesn't always set it with the same bait. Perhaps the bait that would catch you wouldn't catch me. But then there's bait that would catch me and wouldn't catch you. But here was a man who knew what to do. He says, they sought to do me mischief. Now, This man has a settled purpose in life. Look at verse 3. And I sent messengers unto them, saying, I am doing a great work, so that I cannot come down. Why should the work cease, whilst I leave it and come down to you? Yet they sent unto me four times after this sort, and I answered them after the same manner. You see, the enemy never gives in, does he? He doesn't just set the trap once. He sends down the message, come, let's have a little conference together. We'll talk of these things. Perhaps we'll have an agreement. We'll have a little compromise amongst us, and we'll settle things. He said, but I knew they were out for mischief, so I sent to them and said, no, I'm doing a great work. I'm busy with a work that's got to be done. And because I'm busy with this work, I cannot come down and waste time with you. I'm not coming. This work is not going to stop. Four different times they send the invitation. No doubt they sent down their group of men like a committee and explaining the whole thing. We have a place all arranged where we can meet and have a nice time. We may even have a cookout. We may have a supper ready, something or other, and come down and we'll enjoy a time of a good eating together and we'll discuss this. He says, I'm not coming. You see, he determined this because they sought to do me mischief. And because of that, he said, I have a settled purpose in life. And I'm going to continue with my work. Well, now, if they cannot find him to come and have the conference with them, they must determine to do something else. What will the next move be? Look now at verses 5 through 7. Then sent Sanballat his servant unto me in like manner. The fifth time, with an open letter in his hand. Not a sealed letter now. Not a secret thing. An open letter. You know, if I sent a letter to you, or you sent a letter to me, and you marked it private, then the sender knows what's in it, and the receiver knows, and they read the letter. But if I send a letter to the editor of the News and Observer, which I'm not likely to do, by the way, but suppose I did, it's an open letter. It's in the paper. Everybody would know what's in it. And if I sent a letter and slandered somebody, and I wonder at times why some of these people who write editorials don't get taken to court and challenge for some of the slanderous things they write. And even some of the cartoons they put in are slanderous. And some of the things that these politicians say about one another, I wonder at times why they're not challenged when they make it open. He sent an open letter in his hand. Here it is. Everybody can read it. Nothing secret about it. And it was a slanderous letter. Verse 6, wherein was written, it is reported among the heathen, and Gashmu said it, that thou and the Jews think to rebel, for which cause thou buildest the wall, that thou mayest be their king according to these words. And thou hast also appointed prophets to preach of thee at Jerusalem, saying, there is a king in Judah, and now shall it be reported to the king according to these words. Come now, therefore, and let us take counsel together. Plain words, you wouldn't come when we sent you four invitations. All right, here's an open letter now. It's a threat. It's a slanderous letter. Now you'll come now or else we'll report it to the king. You know, that's enough to shake any man or any woman. When they're accused of something false like this, I wonder how Nehemiah would act now. He is a slanderous plot, well cooked up, to present something that isn't true, but it appeared to be true. Because you see, there's certain evidence. They're building a wall, and you know they've got an altar there, and he's setting up his own prophets. And he's going to be the ruler, he's going to be a king. They're going to have a rebellion. Well, if it's taken to law court, he's got a lot of evidence to show. Exhibit number one, exhibit number two, and so on. And if it went to court, perhaps he might win. With all the unjust judges that sit on the benches. What would Nehemiah do now? Verse 8. Then I sent unto him, saying, there are no such things done as thou sayest, but thou feignest them out of thine own heart. That's a straight answer. You're a slanderer, he says. You feign these things out of your own heart. They're not true. I'm not coming. Verse 9. For they all made us afraid, saying, their hands shall be weakened from the work, that it be not done. Now look at that little statement. Isn't that exactly what Nehemiah thought away at the beginning there? But they thought to do me mischief. Here it is. For they made us afraid, saying, their hands shall be weakened from the work, that it be not done. Plain words, we'll stop it yet before it gets finished. This thing must be stopped by hook or by crook. One way or another, we must stop these Jews from building that wall and setting up the religious form again. But notice the last statement, verse 9. What a prayer. Now therefore, O God, strengthen my hands. You see, in spite of the fact that he's got to give an answer, and he says, I'm not coming. Four times I'm not coming. I'm doing a great work. The fifth time when he's threatened, he sends back his report and he says, now look, what you're saying isn't true. It's slander. You've just feigned these things out of your own heart. But then he begins to think, after all, it's beginning to weaken us. Our hands are getting weak. If all my workers hate to hear about this, perhaps they'll be afraid to keep going on. But again, he turns to the Lord. Now therefore, O God, strengthen my hands. Brethren, the only people who need to be strengthened are those who have been growing weak. The doctors in the old days, the old home doctors, you know, the family doctor, he used to say, oh yes, sir, that patient needs a little pick-me-up, you know, a little tonic, just to get them back again to their normal strength. And perhaps you'll have to put them on some special diet, not to lose weight like what they do today, but some special diet to give them strength. What does the Bible say? Joshua, be strong in the Lord. What did the Lord say to Peter? He says, Peter, when thou art turned again, strengthen your brethren. What do we find Peter writing? As newborn babes, desire the sincere milk of the word, that you may grow thereby. What is John writing to the seven churches? Strengthen the things that remain. Beloved, there comes a time when everyone needs to be strengthened. I don't care who it is. Don't run away with the idea that, oh, he's all right or she's all right. That's perhaps the very person who needs a word to strengthen them. The very one you think is so strong, that's perhaps the one who's passing through a time of trial and need to be strengthened. It may be a little word to strengthen them, or it may be a little time with them and pray with them. People need to be strengthened. See, there comes a time when we're all tested. comes a time perhaps when we're being tried. Think of Job. You don't read of anybody getting down and praying with him. They came along and criticized him falsely. Said all nasty things about him. Poor Job. There wasn't one to stand by him, not even his wife. And yet when you come to the end of the story, you see that all the things they were saying about him wasn't true. And then you come to the end of the book and you find that Job's praying for them. The turning point came. He's saying here, now therefore, O God, strengthen my hand. Nehemiah, who was taking the lead amongst them, he felt his own hands were getting weak. Lord, strengthen me for this. In order, of course, that he may be able to strengthen his brethren, that they may go on with the work, in spite of all the nasty opposition from the enemy. You know, when the church first started, there was opposition. You read about that in the Acts of the Apostles. Religious persecution from the Pharisees and the Sadducees, political persecution from Herod and so on. You come down through the history of the church, all the persecution that Christians have had. If you go to Rome now, they take you to the old ruins of the Colosseum. You may get a guide there who'll show you in and say, you know, this is the place where they'll tell you about where they used to throw the Christians to the lions, because they say, oh, you know, you don't believe that. That's not true now. Isn't it? According to them, it's not true now. But according to history, it was true. Go to my own native land. They're trying to do away with the monuments that are there now to the old covenanters. Some of them have been let go into wreck and ruin. You can hardly get a number of people that will give the money to get them renewed and restored. Some of them you can hardly read the writing that's on them now. But these are markers, marking the place where certain of the covenanters were put to death. Yes, they were persecuted. Some were drowned with a rising tide coming in. Some were shot. Some were slain with a sword. As Christians have been persecuted. All down through the ages. But at the present time, the old devil is still busy, and while he may not be persecuting us physically, the devil has let loose a broadside against this book and the teachings of this book. Even right here in Raleigh, no longer have you to believe the things that are written in this book. They've got an answer to them all now. Why was Sodom and Gomorrah destroyed? Why were these people destroyed? It wasn't because of their sin, according to the teachers nowadays, but according to the Bible it was. The stench of their sin came up before God. The time had come for them to destroy the city. They couldn't even find 10 righteous people in it. God destroyed the cities of the place. But today, all these seminary professors, they say, oh, you don't believe that now, do you? Well, the Bible has never changed. Verse 10, afterwards I came unto the house of Shemaiah, so on. Let's get further down here now. Verse 13. Therefore was he hired that I should be afraid and do so and sin, and that they might have matter for an evil report, that they might reproach me. My God, think thou upon Tobiah and Sanballat according to these their works, and on the prophetess Noadai, and the rest of the prophets, that would have put me in fear. He's praying for it all. Then you come to our verse 15. So the wall was finished. That must have been a glorious day. What a day of rejoicing when they saw every stone in place and the gates put on their hinges, the gates able to close, and the people finished the work. What a day of rejoicing. Finished work. What must it have been for Moses when he saw the tabernacle erected and the glory of God filling the tabernacle? What a work. What must it have meant for Solomon after all the plans were laid and the work was done? That great temple of Solomon's was completed and the glory of God filled the temple. Oh, what a day. What a day of rejoicing. I wonder what did it mean in heaven that day when the Lord was on the cross. His last triumphant words, finished. I know our Bible says it is finished. It's all one word, finished. Bowed his sacred head, dismissed his spirit. I've sometimes thought that that triumphant shout must have echoed and re-echoed throughout the arches of heaven. The angels of God up there must have heard that triumphant shout, finish. All heaven must have rejoiced. I wonder what did it mean down in hell with all the lost down there. Wonder what did it mean to the devil that day and to his angels when he heard the triumphant shout. It meant a lot for the Savior, you know, when he came from heaven's glory to this earth. And the years that he spent as a man amongst men, his last 3 years of public ministry in the last week, oh, must have been agonizing torment for him. Concluding that night in the Garden of Gethsemane and going into the high priest's house. In the morning over to Pilate, then by 9 o'clock in the morning to Calvary. For 6 hours, the agony of the cross. 3 o'clock in the afternoon, finished. Means something, doesn't it? Oh, I wonder what did it mean that day for Nehemiah when he says it's finished. And it came to pass that when all our enemies heard thereof and all the heathen that were about us saw these things, they were much cast down in their own eyes, for they perceived that this work was wrought of our God. By the help of God, they completed the work. You remember when the Apostle Paul was dying, lying in a prison at Rome, he wrote that beautiful letter to Timothy. And he says, you know, Timothy, I'm coming near the end now. The time of my departure is at hand. I'm ready to go.